Our next speaker is Aaron Smith from California Baptist.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for spending this next chunk of time with me in this space so we can talk a little bit about the brain's default selves and telos. So in the next 20 minutes, I have two primary objectives. The first is to briefly sketch out what the brain's default mode network is, which I will do by starting with how it was first identified and how it works in relationship to other brain networks and behavior. The second objective is to highlight a few implications related to our understanding of what this default network is related to what it means to be a person and ultimately Christian practice. Because of time, you will find the second objective woefully inadequate. The first one probably also woefully inadequate, but just a little more adequate than the latter. So let's start by continuing on that very pessimistic note, and I'm gonna give you two disclaimers right up front. So the first disclaimer is my training. So I'm trained as a developmental psychologist, which means I'm interested and I study how people change and stay the same across the lifespan. My specific area of expertise is in cognition, so the activities of the mind, and how does it change? How does our thinking change and grow and stay the same? And so in many ways, what I'm going to talk to you about is related to that expertise, but I'm not a neuroscientist. And here I am talking to you about neuroscience research. So we need to understand that I'm coming at this as an insider-outsider, or an outsider-insider, whichever one should go first in that context. However, with this disclaimer, it's important, I think, for people adjacent to neuroscience to dig into this research because of this idea of levels of analysis. So the idea of levels of analysis is that we can ask a question about a single phenomenon at multiple levels of explanation. And if we take levels of analysis, at least the way I do, it's to say that there is not one most fundamental answer to any of these questions. You might actually have multiple correct answers at the same time. And so if you want to ask a question like, what is a self, what is a person, you're probably not going to get there by just talking about the brain, which is what I'm going to do today. You're also not going to get there by just talking about a human unit or just talking about society. Rather, we need the layers to create a robust description and ultimately, hopefully, explanation. The second disclaimer is that the data that I'm going to talk to you about, I'm not giving you any data, this is all other people's research. Like any scientific idea, this is currently hotly debated. So what I am presenting to you is not done and settled science. So you shouldn't go home and say, it has been proven this in the brain, right? Because you shouldn't say that about anything in science, inductive reasoning, but let's set that aside. But I am exposing you to a really kind of robust and developing line of research that in 5 or 10 years might look quite different. And I think that that's an honest assessment of what I'm going to be talking about today. And so with those caveats and my objectives for the remainder of our time, let me start by telling you a little bit about the brain's default mode network. To get an understanding of what is meant by the brain's default, we have to first talk about brain activity more generally. Brain activity, the firing and activation of neurons, neurons being the communication cells that make up the central nervous system, we can measure that brain activity in a number of different ways. Because technology is constantly evolving and changing, new methods are always on the horizon. And these new methods are really cool, they're very illuminating, they're not what I'm going to talk to you about. Instead, some of this research that really has developed this idea of the brain's default mode network has come out of what is now the old tried and true brain technology of the functional magnetic resonance imaging procedure, an fMRI. So fMRIs work by you put a person essentially laying down inside a giant magnet, and what the researchers are going to do is ask the person to engage in some kind of activity, some kind of cognitive activity, like think about a cup, visualize a cup in your mind. Okay, now think about your spouse. And as you engage in these different activities, different parts of your brain are going to be recruited to bring to mind an image of a cup and an image of your spouse. Right. And so what the magnet is doing is measuring changes in blood flow, because blood has magnetic property. You know what else blood has? Nutrients and oxygen. And that's what's required for the maintenance of neuronal activity. So the idea is that where there is blood flow, there is neural activity. And so we can look at changes in what parts of the brain are active in different tasks, because we can see where there is more or less blood flow. But more or less blood flow compared to what, right? So this is a really important question. This is a really important measurement question. fMRIs measure brain activation compared to some pre-existing baseline. There is no such thing as turning your brain off, having zero, and then suddenly thinking of a cup and seeing where in your brain is active. Even when individuals are laying supine, still with their eyes shut inside this fMRI machine, their brain is active, right? It has a particular pattern of activity. Or I guess I should say that was the question, is there a particular pattern of activity? Is there some kind of neural baseline or systematic pattern, intrinsic activity of a brain that we could say is a baseline from which to measure change from? Right, so you're in this fMRI, you're thinking about a cup. What your brain is going to have a particular pattern of activity, that's going to have to be subtracted from some kind of baseline. And so it's a really interesting and important methodological question to ask, is that baseline meaningful in any way? And this is where the default mode network comes in. This problem of meaningful baseline activity, it led Rochelle and colleagues back in 2001 to investigate the extent to which these control measures, which were previously just kind of like junk measures, they took them because they had to. Rochelle and colleagues asked, are those control measurements somehow patterned in any particular way, in a way that might tell us something about how human brains operate? And so they asked whether there is a uniform, organized pattern of brain activity across people that might be able to serve as a benchmark for an inherently meaningful and quantifiable baseline. Their initial work and the body of research that follows, Rochelle published a 2015 paper that's a nice summary of the work between 2001 and 2015, indicated that there is a default mode network, abbreviated DMN, you'll see it in the papers, with a specific pattern of activation that represents relaxed, non-goal-directed neural activity. And this pattern of activity is termed default. Actually, it was initially kind of by accident that it was termed default by Rochelle and colleagues in their 2001 paper, represents the intrinsic internal activity of an awake but resting brain. So the argument here is that activity in the default mode network then can serve as a true baseline, because there's actually a pattern across people, and that this baseline, and this is where I think things start to get interesting, is this same activity that we see present when people engage in self-oriented activities. So when people engage in self-reflection, self-regulation, or even just kind of nondescript internal mind wandering where you get lost in your own inner world, that's activity in this default mode network. And so research converges on this fact that there is this consistency in the default mode network, which you see represented here. It's really along this midline, kind of symmetrical in the prefrontal, the parietal, and the temporal lobes back here. And so the activation, and this is, let me broaden out just a little bit and put the default mode network in the context of other neural networks. The thing about neural networks, which is like a whole other thing, like what defines a neural network is also not quite as clear cut as we might like it to be at this point. But one of the things that is true about neural networks is they have to be distinct from one another. So the word we use is anti-correlated. When one network is on, the other ones have to be off, right? They're not truly off, but relative to this baseline level of activity. And so we see this in the case of the default mode network. So on the previous slide, I showed you a picture of the default mode. It was just zoomed in of this picture, which is the full picture from the 2015 paper. And it's just showing you some other neural networks. But what we see is that when our default mode network is active, we're engaging in this internal self-reflective activity, these other external attention networks, they're silent. So if I think for a moment, oh my gosh, what is everybody thinking about me right now? And I go inward, my default mode network's gonna click on. And now I look back at you and I'm like, look at these people, they're so glad to be here, this is awesome, and I'm thinking about you guys. Now my default mode network toggles off and my external attention networks are gonna toggle on. And this ends up being kind of an important feature of neural networks. One other piece of groundwork that I want to lay here is that the strength of these networks is developed just like how we develop strength of muscle, right? If you want to get buff biceps, you're going to need to do some bicep curls, and you're going to get muscles commensurate with whatever kinds of exercise inputs you give the system. Right now, there's boundaries to that system. Doesn't matter how much I pump iron, I'm not gonna look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? Just like there's boundary systems to how brains develop. Within those boundary systems, our brains reflect the behavior that we consistently feed it. So for example, research on media multitasking suggests that if you're waiting in line at the grocery store, if you're anything like me, you pull out your phone and you start scrolling. You're looking at notifications. You're maximizing every moment of time. 20 years ago, you just sat there bored, right? Internal mind wandering versus external salience. And so we see differences in brain networks as a function of behavior in a way that actually makes it harder today to filter out external activities because we don't have as strong as a toggle switch between these different mode networks because the external networks are over-exercised relative to these internal networks. And so this body of research on default mode networks really converges on this answer that there is a meaningful baseline, right? Again, I'm going to give you the asterisk. Not everybody is on board with that, but quite a few neuroscientists are, that there is a meaningful baseline of activity, this intrinsic brain activity of the brain. And because this activity is so closely associated with other kinds of self-related activities, individuals like Jeff Northoff and colleagues have started to kind of push this argument into an interpretation about what this means for human persons. Really, what does it mean to have or to be a self? And so Northoff and colleagues have argued that this activity in the default mode network, a lot of neuroscience has typically treated the self as this kind of higher order emergent property. You have all these lower level functions, you cobble them together in a specific way and out pops a self, right? But what Northoff and colleagues are arguing out of research on the default mode network is that we need to flip that around, that actually the self is fundamental to how the brain operates. And it's out of the self, this kind of self-specificity, this sense of like an internal world of me, that it is out of that, that higher order cognition emerges, right? Rather than the other way around. And so the argument here is that the self, rather than being a higher order construct, is actually neurologically fundamental, right? So this intrinsic function of your brain, just kind of tickering away, doing whatever it's gonna do in its unguided moments, is you, out of which all the things you do can emerge. And so with interpretations are implications. And so this is where I want to try to highlight that briefly. Before I do, let me just kind of repace this logic in case I've missed a step in my flyby of the previous. So the first piece that we need to know is that the behavior we do produces the brains that we have and use, right? And then from there, there's at least two broad trajectories related to this default mode network. So when we engage in both internal reflection and external attention, but we engage them appropriately with a proper balance, and you guys might ask me, what's proper? We can get into that a little bit, but I don't think it's formulaic here. But when we engage in this kind of intentional, I am in, I am out, we create this healthy anti-correlation between a default mode network and our other external networks. One piece that I'm realizing I didn't mention is that individuals who have either a weaker anti-correlation between the default mode and their external attention networks, or in some cases, a positive correlation between those two, those are individuals that have disorders, right? And so we said, or let me put that in reverse. Individuals who have certain kinds of especially self and identity related disorders are likely to have a diminished anti-correlation or a positive correlation. So you see this in bipolar disorder, you see this in certain cases of psychosis, you see this in other kinds of personality disorders as well. Again, emerging area of research. And so the behavior we have, it produces our brains, and we can have kind of a strong and consistent, like I have an internal and an external world that's reflected in a strongly anti-correlated networked brain. Or we could have behavior that is either too externally focused, right? I'm flipping through my screen rather than ever allowing myself to feel a moment of internal boredom, or too internally focused, in which the reality that I experience is internal rather than external. And so if we have these as kind of our two broad trajectories and options, I think there's really important implications for Christian practice, especially if we want to try to drill down on the proper balance that I've alluded to very vaguely on the previous slide. If we look at what research says, how do we create this kind of proper balance between internal reflection and external awareness, we immediately get sucked into the research on mindfulness, right? Mindfulness, contemplative practices, right? And mindfulness and contemplative practices in terms of the way we might use this word as a spiritual discipline, not necessarily the same thing, but there's certainly a lot of overlap. And so we do see lots of evidence, kind of independent of the Christian tradition, that some of these ancient Christian traditions of contemplation in worship and these spaces for quiet and emotive reflection, we see that in healthy brains today, right? But do we see it in our churches? Depends on what your church is, I suppose, but in many brands of evangelical Christianity in America, we don't. We don't see these places for quiet contemplation. In my other area of research, I study children's ministry. What makes children's ministry effective? How do children come to know Jesus? How can the church care for children who've experienced trauma in a way that can be restorative and reparative? And one of the surprising things that we have found, it's in this 2021 paper, is that children's ministries that incorporate contemplative reflective practices, so times for quiet reflection, right? Get away from the noise, get away from the whiz-bang of sexy children's ministry. Those are actually the ministries that have the best relationships with the kids among themselves, even if they kind of aren't set up that they should have. So there is something about creating space for this internal reflection that actually facilitates social emotional awareness that allows them to engage externally. And we see that in other research and other domains as well. And so I might suggest that this might tell us something about our telos, our purpose as humans. I want to be very careful not to read into this research some kind of telos. I don't think the research can bear that weight, but I certainly think there's a resonance. And I'm willing to engage resonance here. And so with that, thank you so much for your attention.
for the fascinating presentation. We have questions already.
What age would you suggest that in children's ministry that the contemplative reflection process should take place? Where would you suggest that happen? Say in Sunday school.
So our research was started with first graders. First through sixth grade. And you might think, like, first graders, like, they'll be so bored, they'll never want to come back. Because our model of children's ministry is, like, entertain them to Jesus. But I don't think that the church is called to make some subpar parallel version of the world, but rather we are called to be faithful. And I think that we need to do it in developmentally appropriate ways, right? You shouldn't ask a first grader to meditate for an hour. You shouldn't ask most adults to meditate for an hour. Right. And so we can do this in a developmentally appropriate way, but children are quite capable when we create conditions that allow them to be successful.
So would you give an example of one activity?
Yeah. So in one of our most most kind of robust ministries that use these contemplative reflective practices, they would have stations. So they'd have like four or five stations. One was journaling. One would have modeling clay. One was just an altar. And these are all Nazarene churches, mind you. And so they would have these and allow children to have the freedom to choose. Autonomy is a really important part here. How are you going to express whatever your needs are today? How are you going to meet Jesus? And give them a space where they can go and meet Jesus on their terms. And then they're done and they come back. And the other thing is this happened at the end of service. And the children's ministers didn't let the parents pick up the kids until the kids were finished. Because children's ministry is not babysitting. Right? At least it shouldn't be. And so when the children were in this quiet, emotive place, they were able to stay in that space for a minute, for 10 minutes, until they were finished. Right? So that also allows for some developmental leeway. I will say, if you're interested in this, my longtime collaborator, Robert Crosby, he and his wife, his wife is a play therapist. They just wrote a book targeted for kind of a general audience, but it's for children's pastors and children's ministers. And it's called Trauma-Informed Ministry. And it goes through almost the 8 years that we've been doing this research with some really practical how to do this. We're currently running a study where we're training children's ministry volunteers on how do you incorporate trauma-informed principles, including things like contemplative reflective practices into your ministry. Happy to give you more details later. The last name was Crosby.
Robert Crosby.
Robert Crosby, yeah, and his wife, Lori. Yes.
Yes, I heard you mention blood flow and actually the different parts of the brain and how it helps. And I wondered what your take is on plasticity of the brain. I'm a counselor, and a lot of what we do is kind of almost like rewiring.
Yes.
And I find that daydreaming, that the ones that have trauma and are stuck in that place, that when it's hard for them to daydream. And so one of the assignments I give is to daydream about something wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's so hard for them.
Yeah.
But I wondered about the plasticity of relationship with blood flow.
Yeah.
Your take on that, maybe?
Yeah, so neuroplasticity is like my favorite word. I love that word. Because I think it's really powerful. If you want to take a scientific word that talks about grace, I think neuroplasticity is it.
Yes.
So this is what I meant by behavior produces brains, right? So my action is driven out of my brains, but it doesn't make me a kind of unable to make choice, but the choice I make now is going to make it harder or easier for me to make certain choices in the future, because I'm going to have certain patterns of brain wiring that are either stronger or diminished. And so when we engage in specific kinds of practice and blood flows and neurons activate, what we're doing is we're paving a road, right? You can go hiking in the forest where there's no path. That's going to be real difficult. Or you could walk on a well-paved road. Your brain has those same options, right? Which is why learning new things is always hard, because you're in the jungle. The road hasn't been paved yet. Your practice is the paving.
So as a man thinks, so is he.
That's yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's what makes me think of.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So with this default mode network being something that is, my question I guess is it like an implant, and this is just our observance of what we might call a soul or a spirit, or is it a thing that fluctuates, like you're kind of referencing that with certain personality disorders and things, we see it maybe abused and not functioning properly, and how do we, like, where would you navigate kind of wanting to call this the observance of potentially the soul, because then you run into questions of, well, what is the default mode network in a chimpanzee, and what about kids who have the intelligence of a chimpanzee, you know, which takes away from the emergent property of the cell, and like you were saying, trying to put it in a fundamental place, it all of a sudden allows it to be applied to other places in which we normally wouldn't say, oh yes, there's the image of God.
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is I never ever want to locate something we might call a soul in any specific thing. The Hebrew word nefesh, which is often translated soul, as I understand it, is whole being. And if we actually take a look at cognition and we think about extended cognition, that includes things that are outside of our bodies, right? So a master carpenter, when they get really good with a hammer, they have a neural representation that extends their arm into the hammer. That hammer is not a part of their body, but in their brain it is, right? So might that be part of their nefesh, their purpose, their living? I think I'm willing to entertain that idea. So I think that the first question is, I would never want to say that the default mode network like is what it means to be a person. But I think that there are some really important clues around when this default mode network is not functioning properly, what might that tell us about our personhood, right? Especially as we see it related to some of these disorders. And what are our pathways to help ameliorate the suffering that disruption causes, right? And I think Christians are called to be agents of reconciliation in that capacity. Yeah.
Another question over there.
Thank you very much. I'm involved in my university with contemplative practice for students. We have a debate about the appeal. Do we say, this is a tradition of the church, this is the way to spend time with God? Do we say, this is good for your mental health? This is going to help your brain, this is going to make you a better student. Do you have any thoughts on the appeal?
Is there a reason you don't want to tell them both?
I mean, you do have them both. I mean, you have to choose focus, right?
I think that's a great example for a randomized trial, and you make two sets of posters, two sets of advertisements, you randomly email to different students and have them come on, different days, see who shows up and what drove them there. There's some really good social science research I can point you to that does that. Because I don't think that, me today, you get me with ancient Christian traditions, I'm there. Me as a student, that sounds so boring, right? But I don't know if there is kind of one right answer. But if the goal is to try to meet individuals where they were at, it seems like we need to figure out who are the vast majority of those to whom you are trying to reach. Which camp are they in? Yeah.
One last question.
You mentioned a lot of research with children's ministry. Is there any research with this?
In terms of contemplative reflective practices, not in a church service, but there is a ton of research on what happens inside of people when they engage in mindfulness or contemplative, whether it be spiritual or secular kinds of practice. Yes, in many ways, are pushing this question down into the children's ministry. That's the new part, because there's quite a bit of research in adults looking at social support, which is the actual construct that we use, this relational connection. There's a lot of work in adults on that and how powerful it is in a church context. And then there's work on the contemplative side, but no one's done it with kids because research with kids is really hard.
Sorry, to clarify, it's not a new question. The brain activity with mindfulness and prayer, is that similar to the default mode?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question. Okay. I know the research. So Andrew Newberg is kind of like the big name in the field now. He's kind of like the old name in the field now too, but he's a good place to start to branch out to try to find answers to that question.
But if you're suggesting that meditation takes us to that default.
So it's really interesting. I think the research on mindfulness and meditation with these networks sometimes has some contradictory findings in terms of which network. And some of that is how we do mindfulness, because some mindfulness is actually externally oriented, grounding and being aware of your present moment. And some is more contemplative, looking inward. And so one of the things that I love is the contradictions in the research. That's opportunity, which is why I told you this same presentation in 5 years might look very different, because there's a lot of really important questions being asked right now.
Well, we'll see you again. Thank you very much.